As we were singing I'll Live in Glory, I sort of felt like Yogi Berra. I was experiencing deja vu all over again, since we had already sung that song at the beginning. We should have just gone right ahead, brother. That would have been just fine. Sing it twice. I so appreciate all of you coming tonight. Irma has come our way. I have been told that I am a bad weather magnet. We were talking about this at the potluck on Sunday, and I told a story about preaching in Stephenville, Texas in March one year. It was like 80 degrees when I drove up for the meeting on Saturday, and I started the meeting on Sunday. Stephenville's right out to the west of Fort Worth. And on Sunday night, I preached a sermon called How to Kill a Lion on a Snowy Day. And on Tuesday, during the meeting, we had 4 inches of snow, and everyone blamed me. And that's just one of the occasions where I brought bad weather to a meeting. And so we just went through Hurricane Harvey, and so I decided I would bring Irma with me this week. So you can blame me if it gets bad tonight. I don't think we're going to see anything like Florida saw in regard to Hurricane Irma. But I appreciate you coming tonight, and we have some longtime friends in the audience tonight. In fact, when Aaron Gabardi and I were talking, and Sherry and I were talking with him in the back, he was at our wedding. He was what, 3 at the time? No, he was 10 or so, but he's a little older now, and it's good to visit with him. And Kenny and Beth Moore have come down from Florence. And I got to tell you, when I was at Florida College, I spent more time in Beth Hibbett's office, who's now Beth Moore, than I did in the library. I mean, we spent a lot of time with Beth, and she entertained us on a regular basis. And Kenny and I have an interesting connection in terms of our hometowns, little places that people don't know. Kenny is from Bald Knob, Arkansas, and I'm from Floyd's Knobs, Indiana. So we know what cities called the Knobs are, or towns. I don't know if it could be called cities. But I've always thought that's an interesting connection that Kenny and I have. But it's so great to see all of you tonight as we continue our series, Unearthing Godly Passion. Set your affections on things above and not on things of this earth. Now, as I talked to Kevin about this meeting and about this topic and serving others, and having a passion for that, what I didn't know is that your final quarter of the year is entitled Serving Others with Passion. So I'm not sure how all that worked out. But that's coming up beginning in October. I saw the little pamphlet that you all have about your theme for the year. So this is sort of like the introduction to the final quarter of the year. And the last two lessons in this series, tomorrow night we'll talk about our comfort or the Father's will. Sometimes we're faced with that decision and choice. We'll talk about that. And then finally, maintaining your confidence will conclude our series of lessons, Lord willing, on Wednesday night. Tonight's lesson actually came out of a golf tournament. Every year in Lyndale, Texas, there is what is called the GPGA. That sounds all official. Sounds like a golf tournament, doesn't it? GPGA means the Gospel Preacher Golf Association. It was a tournament started by about 12 or so preachers in Texas. And now we let the sinners come. You know, that's what we talk about. It's not just a preacher's tournament. And there's all kinds of jokes that go on about this tournament. But about 20 preachers and about 80 other guys show up every year, and preachers are sinners too. I'm just kidding about that. And we do this every year, and since my friend Chris Emerson took over a couple years ago, we've been doing on Tuesday night a short devotional. We play golf during the day, and then that night we get together and eat a meal and have a short devotional on Tuesday nights. And this year, Chris was doing the devotional, and he ran out this idea, and after it was over, I thought, man, I went to talk to Chris. Chris Emerson, by the way, great preacher, good friend of mine. And you may not have ever heard of him. He's the best kept secret in Texas when it comes to preaching. But I said, Chris, you do have this in a sermon, right? And he said, well, no. I said, you mean you just rolled this out for a little devotional? I said, this is a great sermon idea. And so I went home and started working on it, became a sermon. He started working on it, became a sermon. And so we've sort of compared notes and combined some of the ideas that we had. So this is sort of a collaboration that Chris and I came up with together. And it's from a familiar story in the Old Testament. And I'm going to assume, like I did last night in regard to the story of Joseph, that you know something about the story of 1 Samuel 17. I bet all of our young kids know a lot about this story of David conquering the giant, Goliath. You might have known I was going to this text when you saw the flyer that said something about conquering your giants. You probably thought of Goliath when you saw that title. I know as I walk up to my office at the building at Decker Prairie, I turn the corner on the staircase and there it is. They have it marked on the wall, the height of Goliath. And I always do this number. And I think of Yao Ming, the guy that used to play for the Houston Rockets, the Chinese guy who was like 7 feet 6 inches. And he was a massive guy. I mean, I stood next to a guy that was 7 foot 4. And I remember but this Goliath is much taller than that. And so we need to be impressed with the size of this man who taunted the armies of the living God, as we've read so often in 1 Samuel chapter 17, as he said, I defy the ranks of Israel. And the thing that you might pass over in the beginning section, as we look at the size of this man, his shield, his armor, his sword, we look at all of that and we're impressed with this picture that's drawn of this fella. How long did this go on? 40 days. More than a month and 10 days. He is defying any man in the army of God, the army of Israel, to take his challenge. And no one would step forward. In comes David. Saul and Israel are dismayed and greatly afraid of this giant. And yet David says, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Now, his older brother, Eliab, he has 3 brothers in the army of Israel. None of them stepped forward. And so when he comes down to check on the welfare of his brothers sent by his father Jesse, Eliab accuses David of being up to mischief. You just wanted to come down and see what's going on down here. You're insolent and rebellious, he says in verse 28. And his anger burned against David, it says. But David has asked the question, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine in verse 26? And so ultimately, he's brought before King Saul, and he makes this statement, let no man's heart fail on account of him. And then when he finally meets the challenge, rejects Saul's armor in a very politeful way, and comes to face the giant with his sling and a few stones. You come to me with sticks? Goliath looked at David with disdain, but David came with great courage. He had learned when tending his father's sheep that God was with him, and he delivered the lion and the bear to David. And so he says, I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God of Israel. David had the kind of godly passion that we want to cultivate, that kind of confidence in God that we need. And so then the text says, then it happened. In verse 48, I have those words underlined. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David. And then I have this underlined. David ran quickly toward him. There was no hint of fear or concern. He ran toward his adversary. He ran quickly toward him to meet him. He put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone, I've always loved this when I was a kid, I remember, the stone sank in his forehead. And I thought about that. I had that image in my mind. And then he fell on his face to the ground. How that must have sent a shockwave. This massive man falling to the ground on his face. The earth no doubt trembled when he fell. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. He killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand, showing the extraordinary nature of this victory. And then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And then when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. I mean, that's sort of a gruesome picture. You think about, you know, you see it in movies now. I mean, this is common fare in those kinds of violent war movies that are done today. But he has his head in his hand. And so the men of Israel pursued the Philistines, and the victory then ensues. Well, I've already hinted at this. I'm going to do something with this story that you've heard many times before. I want to call it the typical instruction that we get from 1 Samuel chapter 17, that we need to be like David, to have the kind of conviction that he had that was missing in others in Israel. Why wouldn't his brothers, if they had the same kind of faith, why wouldn't they have met the challenge? And the bigger question is, why hasn't King Saul taken up the challenge? It's been going on for 40 days. He was a warrior. Why hadn't Saul accepted the challenge? Or then even, there's no mention of his presence, but I'm assuming that he's there, as great of a character as he is. Not even Jonathan has accepted this challenge. And so we come to this story and we talk about the fact, if we could immediately summon these qualities on the spiritual battlefield, if we would be people in our everyday lives of conviction, our confidence in God and His Word, and have the kind of courage to say yes to God, to be zealous for God, and to oppose our adversary, the giants that stand before us, and if we would overcome, the message of the book of Revelation, is it not? He who overcomes will inherit all things. I mean, the book of Revelation is about the faithful overcoming despite incredible odds and obstacles, persecution, threats. From an earthly point of view, it looks very dire. But with God, there is victory. And so we can talk about these qualities. The typical instruction. Now, I would say this about the typical instruction, about the possession of these qualities. These qualities that you need on the spiritual battlefield, they don't just happen. They won't just happen for you. They didn't just happen for David. You don't just wake up one day and all of a sudden you're a person of conviction, confidence, and courage. If you sit at the feet of very good Bible class teachers and sit in enough Bible classes and hear enough good sermons, that as D. Bowman would say, storm the will. If you rub elbows with the right people long enough, that you'll then have these qualities. These qualities have to be nurtured. David teaches us that. These qualities were being nurtured as he was tending his father's sheep, as he was reflecting on God, as he had meditative moments, thinking about his relationship with God and how much he needed him. This didn't just happen overnight. He didn't just wander onto the battlefield and say, hey, I think I can take this guy. I've got the stuff to do it. He has developed these qualities over time. It's going to take time. And when we talk about godliness, serving with godly passion and unearthing that and taking away the clutter so that that can shine in our lives. One of the mistakes we make with the word godly or godliness is that we talk about godlike, because, you know, godly sort of looks like godlike, and the godly person is godlike, and so we talk about imitating God's character. But really, that's not a sufficient explanation of the term. Think about its opposite for Christians. Worldly. Instead of godliness, there's worldliness. Well, what is worldliness? Well, yes, it's being like the world, but worldliness is a focus on the world. To be godly and to have godly passion is to be focused on God in our lives. And that's what David was, and that's how he maintained these qualities. And because of that, David was then able to be undeterred by others' fear. The ranks of Israel were afraid of Goliath. He was undismayed by the enemy's threats. And so, as we talk about the typical instruction, I want to suggest to you that we need to warrior up as God's people. I'm not so sure that we really grasp the concept of warfare. You know, warfare is a very common term and idea in the New Testament. We talk about putting on the full armor of God from Ephesians 6. You're probably well familiar with those passages. And the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty to God, to the destruction of fortresses. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, the weapons of our warfare, we talk about passages like that. But I don't know about you, but when I see battle depicted, I mean, I really struggle to understand that. I knew some World War II vets when we worshiped in Baytown among those saints there. We were there for 12 years, and two of those fellows, Andrew Dalquist and Johnny Park, were wonderful men that Sherry and I loved a great deal. They were two men of America's greatest generation. They fought in World War II. Johnny would come to tears when he thought about the liberation of people from one of the Germans' camps. Andrew was wounded. A German stood over him and shot at him several times trying to kill him, but he survived. And they had some great stories. I listened to some of those same stories several times, but they were classic stories of men who understood some things about warfare. Great men. Who understood some things about spiritual warfare. It's a war that we're in, and sometimes I don't know that we perceive it like we should. You think the devil is at work today on the spiritual battlefield? Do you think, and that's what Ephesians 6 is really talking about the spiritual forces that are at work. Do you think the devil is probably trying to undermine the marriages of Christians? Do you think he's trying to undermine unity among brethren in the local church? Do you think he's behind the easy access to sin that is so prevalent in our culture? Folks, don't ever forget that we're on a very serious spiritual battlefield. And overcoming is going to require tenacious activity. And that's really what we're doing. I mean, we're expending of ourselves this week for a few days, for a few extra moments in study of the Word of God to help us on this great spiritual battlefield. That's what I'm here to do. How effective I do that, I hope the Lord is using me in an effective way, but that's what this is about. Be devoted to prayer. Romans chapter 12 and verse 10. Why? Because we're on a spiritual battlefield. But having said all of that, I could go on for the rest of our time tonight about warrioring up in this great cause and making sure we've donned the spiritual armor that Paul talks about in Ephesians chapter 6. But after we've talked about all of the encouraging words to be like David in the spiritual warfare, I'm about to say something to you that you have likely not heard before. And this is what my friend Chris brought to my attention that I thought was a really special point and goes beyond the typical instruction that we do with the story of David and Goliath. Probably not heard this before. If you have, you'll get the gold star I talked about last night. Again, it's not worth much. It's Tony's gold star, but you get it if you've already had this thought before. Have you heard this before? We are not like David in this story. Now, I don't mean to sell you short. Now remember, I'm including myself when I say this. We are not like David. I mean, what makes me think that if I had been in the army of Israel, that I would have accepted Goliath's challenge? I'm afraid of snakes, as I told you last night. And my little sister's rubber alligator that she chased me around with. Kenny and Beth were just with my sister last week, I think it was, and yeah, she's rotten. My little sister is. Now, you got the sense of that last night. I don't have any problem saying that publicly in front of people that she knows. But if I was afraid of a rubber alligator and snakes, I don't think I was. Okay, I'm ready. I'm going to take on the giant. I had done all the preparation, all the spiritual warfare preparation, the meditation that David had done. I would have been out there. Again, if Jonathan wasn't out there, I would have been three or four men deep, cowering somewhere over the taunts of this giant. And I just make this observation about that. That we need more of us on the spiritual battlefield, not standing on the sidelines, but leading the charge against the strongholds of Satan. And when we see a brother and sister in a spiritual struggle, not waiting on the elders to address it, but us being compassionate and caring, brothers and sisters try to reach someone who might be in the snares of the evil one. Too much standing and sitting on the sidelines. We need more individuals like David and Isaiah who say, "Here am I, send me." Folks who aren't content with what they've been for the last 10 or 15 years, but will strive for something more. But that's not really where I'm going with this point. Because you see, all of us have an obstacle and a giant that has stood before us that we could not conquer. Not without assistance from the greatest spiritual warrior that there ever was. And it's perhaps what Jesus was going to do for all of us. Perhaps that is what this story more represents. What Jesus did with your greatest adversary and my greatest adversary, when I could not conquer it and defeat it, Jesus took on the giant of the problem of our sin. And so I want you to re-envision the Goliath event from the standpoint of Jesus being undeterred by others' fears, undismayed by the enemy's threats, and they were severe against him as he took on our greatest adversary and he bore in his body on the cross our sin and conquered our giant. What was the result of David's victory over Goliath? Did you notice how all of a sudden the army of Israel is now energized? And while they were sitting in their tents before in fear, now they are strengthened for the fight and they follow after their king, their future king. They follow after the warrior David, and now they follow him and they fight for him and they are fueled by his efforts. And that's exactly what Jesus does for us. He conquered our giant, and he has equipped us now to fight the good fight of faith, and we can be victors according to 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4 because of the work of our king and our leader, and he gives us fuel for the fight. So may we never forget that we are debtors to him. There is no place on this earth in the kingdom of Jesus for big shots, for people who get carried away with themselves and their perceived place in the kingdom. I'll tell you what, if I'm not around, this kingdom is going to go on without me. I'm just a bit player, a part-time player in this thing. Let me contribute to this great cause in whatever way that God equips me to do so, but I am not a person who is not expendable. This will carry on without me. And so many times, local churches experience problems because people aren't poor in spirit. We get carried away with themselves and their importance. This isn't about me. I am what I am because of Christ. Even the great apostle Paul said that. I am what I am because of him, and let's not ever forget that. We must always maintain, no matter what we achieve or whatever we're able to accomplish or how much we're able to effectively serve in his cause, that we are only enabled to do so because of the warrior who went before us, Jesus Christ. When I went to Florida College, as I mentioned, back in those days when I was, should have been in the library, but was being amused by Beth and my friends at FC, I was going to be a sports broadcaster. That was what I mean, probably one of the few guys that ever went down to Florida College whose life goal was to be a sports broadcaster. I mean, I was going to go to FC for a couple of years, but then I was going to go to Western Kentucky, and I was going to get my communications degree, and I was going to be the next voice of the Cincinnati Reds. That was what I sort of envisioned. Maybe Kentucky Wildcats basketball, following in the footsteps of the great Kaywood Ledford. But really, I thought maybe the Cincinnati Reds would be a better place for me to go. That would have been a huge career mistake. Because the voice of the Cincinnati Reds when I was a little kid was Marty Brenneman, and he is still the voice of the Cincinnati Reds. That would have been a mistake. So I started taking all these speech classes at Florida College under Dr. Guy Warner. And so I started doing a little preaching then. When I first went down to Florida College, my mom and dad, remember that orange Camaro I told you I drove down to Florida College? But about time I got that car, my mom and dad said, "Tony, you ought to think about being a gospel preacher." I said, "Are you kidding? I can't do that." And there's still some people that agree with that assessment. So I go down to Florida College. I'm going to be a sports broadcaster, start taking all these speech classes, and did a little preaching on the side, started preaching every other Sunday night, or maybe one Sunday night a month, I can't remember, over in the Seminole congregation. Claude Wilsford was the preacher there, and longtime family friend, used to preach in Indiana. And then I'll never forget that night. It was the second year that I was at FC. It was in the February of 1983. I went to lectures that night, and Dee Bowman was speaking. And the topic was from Romans chapter 1, I am ready to preach the gospel. And Dee, doing what he does so well, stormed the will. And I went back to the dorm room that night and called my mom and dad, and I said, I've decided I'm going to preach the gospel. And they said, you got to be kidding. And then I told my classmates, and they said, you got to be kidding. But that began the journey, because I realized that if I had the ability to do that, and because of what Jesus had done for me, that I was a debtor to preach. Not everybody can be a preacher. I understand that. But I felt like that's what I should do. And sometimes, as I talked last night about the rigors of the Christian life, sometimes you forget about the why. But this is the why of service, the why of godly passion. And I got to tell you this is what comes out of this lesson. This is the concluding point tonight. I couldn't preach this without thinking about Romans chapter 8. It is because of Jesus' work and because of his help that he says, we overwhelmingly conquer. We are more than conquerors, Paul said in Romans chapter 8. Conquerors over tribulation and distress and persecution and famine and nakedness and peril and sword. I mean, those are some serious things. Those are some extreme, toughest kinds of things. And yet Paul says, we overwhelmingly conquer those things. But don't miss this point. Through him who loved us. Not life, not death, not angels, not principalities, things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth. Not any created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. We are conquerors on the battlefield, but we are conquerors because of him. We've been talking some this week in some of the conversations we've had about people that we lose. People who choose not to serve the Lord, who choose not to fight alongside Jesus, our great King, and the one who enables us to conquer. They don't believe it's worth the investment. I don't know if we're losing more young people than the previous generation did, but I think we may be. At least that's my experience. We live in times where people are self-sufficient, self-reliant, feeling as if that they are invincible, impervious to forces greater than themselves. They have the world by the tail. They don't need Jesus. Young people, I got a message for you. Older folks, I got a message for you about this. That is an illusion. All of that is an illusion. Sin, unremedied, will be your undoing. Don't ever doubt that. Sin without remedy will be your undoing. And the final observation is this: Jesus lives, Jesus reigns, and Jesus provides your needs. One verse and we'll be done tonight. Proverbs chapter 24 and verse 16. Proverbs 24 and verse 16. For a righteous man falls seven times and rises again. We've been that guy. But the wicked stumbles in time of calamity. That's the choice that is set before you. You're going to go it on your own? The time of calamity is inevitable. If you choose, and if you say, I don't need the Lord, you can't conquer your giants without the Lord and His help. The righteous have their struggles. They fall at times, they stumble. But with the Lord's help, they can rise again. Is there someone in this audience tonight who needs to get back on the right course? Can we assist you? Can we pray with you tonight? Is there someone in this audience who has decided to go it alone, thinking you don't need the Lord? Sin will be your undoing. You need to fix it while there's time and opportunity. Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling upon the name of the Lord. Let's stand and sing.